through the various forms of interpretation within the galleries, across the gallery spaces, and of course through the net. And of course it happens through our education programs. And the dialogues that we've been having with artists and writers, curators, researchers, and of course other members of our audience are crucial to this process. And in a sense, I think maybe that's partly what the Goodison Room display that has been upstairs of Aubrey's work is about. That room really provides an interesting contemplative space, almost like a studio exhibition or a small gallery exhibition, that's quite different from our main collection displays, and that I think is maybe perhaps quite unusual for an art museum. And of course, his work has its place in the canon of late 20th century British painting, and works of his from the Tate collection have recently been shown in the gallery in this context. But what this display in the Goodison Room does is that it allowed curators, and it certainly allows the audience, to consider Aubrey Williams more deeply and to become, perhaps as he was, absorbed somehow in the project of his own practice. And it allows us to view the variety of his work in both form and subject, as well as realising some common aesthetic and thematic concerns for this painter, the striking colour palette, the quest to create time and space in the picture, the exploration of relationships between different art forms, and the preoccupation perhaps with both destructive as well as beautiful human impulses and actions. And today, I think we're extremely lucky to have a group of artists, writers, filmmakers, curators, and art historians, several of whom knew Aubrey Williams personally, and of course we're very lucky to have members of Aubrey's family here as well. And through the presentations and conversations today, I hope we'll be able to illuminate his work and its legacy and its importance to British and international art. Now, the session will open with a number of presentations, and we will hold questions until later in the session. There'll be a tea break midway through, and then, of course, there'll be a reception afterwards, which you're all very, very welcome to stay for. Just a couple of housekeeping points. The fire exits are here. Should any alarms go off, do make your way in this direction. And the toilets are just out of the front doors, not the front doors, out of the auditorium doors, down the corridor and at either side. I feel like an air hostess doing this. but before all that, it's really my great pleasure to introduce the first presentation, which will be prefaced by a short excerpt from the film The Mark of the Hand by Imran Bukhari, who will also be speaking later. So our first presentation is from Guy Brett, who is a curator and writer and critic who I'm sure many of you will be very familiar with. Guy has published extensively on British and international artists over the past four decades, including, of course, essays on Aubrey, and has organised many international exhibitions exploring local and transnational concerns, thinking about aesthetics and the cultural condition. So Guy will be our next presentation. Thank you.
Aubrey's paintings are exhibited internationally. The Western critical response usually places his concerns and intentions within the developments of Western modern art. The influences of the Guyanese landscape and pre-Columbian culture have not been perceived. The London-based critic Guy Brett is an exception.
Aubrey, how does Shostakovich relate to your other great involvement with pre-Columbian myth and pre-Columbian figures?
I think it shows the universality of the work of Shostakovich, his incorporation of these different human vibrations, in that there's no conflict. There's no conflict at all in my involvement with pre-Columbian artifacts and pre-Columbian life, as it were, because my involvement with pre-Columbian artifacts and my work out of this spheres of human existence takes into account all the organic expressions of that life. Very early on in the old country, when I first heard the music of Shostakovich, I heard the first symphony in which he used a piano as just another instrument in the orchestra.
Well, how old were you then?
I was in my teens, my early teens. And this music hit me. It hit me really hard because I was hearing for the first time a sort of total sound. To me, for the first time, music had rather profound visual connotations. I could feel color.
So it was something to do with the way that Shostakovich brought together different musical forms or idioms.
This I came to understand in Europe, where I had the means backing research into Shostakovich. Then I came to understand that these intrinsic values that I picked up psychically nearly in the old country were valid and did exist, in that the man was so universal in his creativity, in that he paid so much attention to early Chinese, Indian, African music, American jazz. I came to understand these things, and then it had new relevance to the importance of Shostakovich as a universal composer to me. And what you're seeing here is paintings from how I feel about the music of Shostakovich. You know, recently, on reflection, because as I grow older, I reflect a little more. I don't take everything for granted like I used to. I myself have been terribly surprised, greatly surprised, when I look back and I see the sort of double isolation that I have existed in for over 30 years. It's just mind-bending. There wasn't only the emotional exile from my country. It was also an isolation in subject, in an isolation in my very oeuvre, you know, where for years, even up to now, till meeting you and other people I hold dear, I had no minds to throw my ideas up against or to mix my ideas with. For a very long time, I have existed in an aesthetic desert.
In the evolution of your work, where do you feel you are now, today?
In a way, I'm blessedly just as lost and complicated and I'm finding out more about my direction, myself, and my work. And fighting not to do too many things. But I want to do every damn thing, every aspect of my work, more than ever now. Now that I think I know a little bit about how to go about it. But oh man, I would need about 3 more lifetimes to do what I find myself now able to do. Mm-hmm. More preoccupation with pre-Columbian artifacts.
Yes, because you've linked that up. You've linked that up very much, that inspiration, with contemporary world problems like the destruction of the environment and ecology and things like that.
I see now definitely that we're repeating ourselves. We are repeating the Maya mistake, where we are not keeping up with our technology. Our technology is galloping ahead, and we are struggling to keep in terms with it. We seem to have lost our chance of catching up with our technology. And this anxiety is what informs my work. This human predicament, this modern human predicament. And now I'm getting to grips with expressing it. The canvas is becoming more and more alive for me.
Well, it was very moving to see Aubrey speaking there. I hadn't seen Imru's film for many years, so it was a wonderful beginning, I think. I thought, by way of introduction to today's discussion, I would try to identify where we are now in terms of the public accessibility study and interpretation of Aubrey Williams' paintings, whose powerful energies, brilliant color, and turbulent inner struggles will perhaps always exceed our efforts to interpret them. A work like Symphony No. 5, Opus 47, is a landmark of painting in this country. Not only an overwhelming painterly cataclysm, but a mystery, something to seeming to contain an important meaning that begs to be deciphered. I realize that up to now, a large part of the effort of a significant number of people, first and foremost Eve and Maridal Williams, and also other members of the Williams family, the October Gallery, Third Text, Iniva, independent critics and a filmmaker, scholars, curators of the Tate Gallery, members of the Aubrey Williams Committee. A large part of these efforts have been directed to righting a wrong. All have worked to end the marginalization of Williams on the British art scene, internal exile, as he once described it, and to give him his rightful place as a major painter of his generation. A lot of progress has been made in this direction, as the Tate Britain exhibition and this gathering exemplify. So that discussions now, I believe, have more opportunity to concentrate on Aubrey's work itself. Similarly, it has been necessary to stress Aubrey's unique contribution to a mainstream practice in contemporary art, abstract painting. An abstract painting of what, for convenience, is called a gestural kind. It has been necessary, tactically, if not artistically, to establish this first. But now attention can fall more on his overall practice and the diversity of what he produced. Obviously, there's a complex relationship in his work between abstraction and figuration. In terms of range, Williams can move from the assured storytelling mode of his series on Guyanese mythology to his sequence of series of bird paintings, to the hybrid of abstraction and figuration in his Olmec Maya series, to the Shostakovich paintings, in whose abstraction what may be seen as references to music are inseparable from pre-Columbian symbolic forms and astronomic energies. And incidentally, Aubrey painted a series called Cosmos, which again exemplifies his kind of meeting between figurative imagery and abstraction, from the mid-1980s. In a certain way, his figurative work all points to his abstraction, where powerful forces are at play and contributes to its multi-suggestiveness. How do these differences reflect changes in his own thinking, and how much are they due to vicissitudes in his own life, or struggles around the possibilities of painting? I feel there's a great deal more to say about what abstraction may mean in Aubrey's paintings. And I would give his bird paintings a large part of this totality. This is the keel-billed toucan, by the way. But I have to admit, at first, I didn't give Aubrey's paintings of birds a great importance. I thought of him as primarily an abstract painter, whatever that may mean today, and I still do. But looking again at his birds, this is the black-necked Arikari, and also the way his birds often look at us, I came to realize they are part of his vision of what he wanted to tell us. They face us. Many of his birds are a threatened species. They face us like witnesses, each in the individuality of his or her gorgeous plumage, witnesses of the damage we are doing to our planet. Nevertheless, despite progress made in rendering Aubrey's work visible, I continue to believe that actual comparison, side by side in the same space or gallery, of Williams' paintings with those of his contemporaries, has yet to yield, on a visual level, the full scope and subtlety of the cross-cultural amalgams and insights that the British art scene offers in the last 60 or 70 years. Yes, it amounts to a long period of time. An immense loss was entailed to our understanding and experience of the modern world in its process of change, because there was a lack of opportunity to compare both common projects and cultural difference to the greatest degree of refinement, of nuance, in the non-verbal language of painting, a kind of painting that was mostly abstract and therefore not impeded by single meanings and the tyranny of images. Incidentally, I only learned yesterday from Cobbina Mercer's excellent essay in the anthology Discrepant Abstraction, as it recently published by Univer, that Williams's work was seen alongside Graham Sutherland's, Victor Passmore's, and Henry Moore's in the 1962 Commonwealth Institute exhibition, Commonwealth Art Today. I didn't have time to look further into this, although I noticed that this show was selected by Dennis Bowen, artist and then joint director of the New Vision Centre, one of the few galleries to offer a genuine international outlook on contemporary art at the time. And as Cobbina Mercer himself writes, and I quote, "The enframing association with the Commonwealth Institute may have contributed to perceptions of the Caribbean and South Asian modernists as a class apart from the increasingly North American orientation of the British art world." The Tate rejected an offer of Williams's work by collector Dr. Charles Damiano in 1961 and didn't reverse its decision until the 1990s. Incidentally, I can recommend this book for the study of Aubrey Williams, but besides Mercer's essay, it includes a remarkable conversation between the poet Nathaniel Mackey and the writer Wilson Harris. Aubrey Williams arrived in London as a young artist in 1952, aged 26, with a unique combination of experiences. An agronomist's knowledge of the flora and fauna of his country, picked up during his work as an agricultural officer in the Guyanese hinterland. Political experience of a moment of profound historical change, the transition from colonial to independent status of his country. A deep curiosity about the pre-Columbian Amerindian culture of Central and South America. And memories, human affective ones, of an indigenous people, the Warao, among whom he lived for a time, and for whom life and art were closely interconnected. And there was a further influence, equally specific to his time and place, that of two contemporary artistic streams. Painters of the South American continent, the Mexicans Rivera, Orozco, and Tamayo, and the Chilean Mata, and painters of North America, Pollock, Gorky, Klein, Rothko, and others. The period in which Aubrey absorbed these influences was in fact one in which there was a unique contact and interplay between artists and other intellectuals of North and South America. Closer than before or since, I believe. The influence of Alfredo Siqueiros on Jackson Pollock is one example. And Aubrey was in the remarkable position of being open to both these streams, acting as a kind of synthesizing cell of the two. By contrast, British painting had very little appeal for him. I'm not forgetting the intellectual crucible that was the Caribbean Artist Movement, founded in 1966, of which Aubrey was an early member. But I will leave all reference to that to Anne Walmsley, whose superb book on the subject opened my eyes to a part of history I knew nothing about. Perhaps for the very reason that Aubrey felt estranged from British art, comparisons between his work and that of his British peers working in the same mode of expression and abstraction or semi-abstraction are fascinating. think this could do with a bit of focusing. I'll try myself. Threads of shared inspiration as well as differences can be found. The fact that the paintings in question may be separated by stretches of time doesn't affect their interconnections, I believe. On an external level, one can point to several intriguing connections between Williams's work and that of, for example, Peter Lanyon and Alan Davy. Are you able to bring up the previous slide on the right-hand side? Or the first slide on the right-hand side, my control isn't... Is there not one before that? Yeah. I'm making this comparison between Audrey Williams and Peter Lanyon and Alan Davy. This is Peter Lanyon's painting, Thermal, in the Tate Collection. These go beyond the obvious fact that all practiced a type of large-scale gestural painting, and in Williams's and Davy's case were drawn to symbolic forms. All three had a connection with music. Davy is a jazz enthusiast and even played in a jazz orchestra in his early years. Jazz improvisation was cited in Caribbean Artists Movement meetings as an analogy for Caribbean literary and artistic creation. Williams spent 10 years painting a series inspired by Shostakovich's music. He also played the violin and sang, as did his paternal grandfather, the dominant influence in his childhood. Lanyon, too, came from a musical family. His father was a composer and pianist, as well as an amateur photographer. All three artists had an emotional, spiritual affinity with flight. Davy and Lanyon were both gliding enthusiasts. Lanyon died in a gliding accident, and all identified with birds. How much more important than art just to be a bird, declared Davy. My pictures are concerned with birds describing the invisible, their flight across cliff faces and their soaring activity, Lanyon said. And Williams, as we've seen, produced a series of bird portraits. Of them, he said, to me, birds represent the unattainable, possessing qualities we can only admire from our limited human state. Furthermore, all three identified strongly with an ancient cultural or environmental heritage. Davy has claimed that the roots of his symbolism are, I quote, in my Celtic heritage. He was born at Grangemouth, Scotland, in 1920. Lanyon stressed an ancestral link with the Cornish landscape, and pre-Columbian culture was William's lifelong preoccupation. Of course, these common enthusiasms can be related to desires which inspired the kind of painting all three artists practiced. Spontaneous improvisation, freeing oneself in the act of painting, tapping the unconscious, and so on. But the ways in which this phenomenon is all of a piece sensitizes one all the more to differences. One has a certain feeling at an intuitive level that the British artist's notion of freedom entailed an escape from self-control, whereas for Williams, the same freedom was associated with containing chaos. Looking at Aubrey Williams's painting Guyana in 1965 compared with David and Lanyon's paintings of roughly the same date, we might recall the artist's own words, which were addressed to a meeting on Caribbean art. This is Aubrey speaking. We are still in a position to contemplate terrestrial reality. Ours is a beautiful landscape, unbelievably beautiful in some cases. But as compared to the ordered landscapes in the countries that have been overlived in, ours is bizarre, unreal, incongruous. On the right now is Alan Davies' painting Feast, 1957. Davy borrowed symbols freely from ancient Egypt, Syria, Mexico, Hopi Indians, etc., as well as those he defined as Celtic. Williams, too, admitted to many influences, but a word like borrowing hardly describes the intensity of his identification with Carib and Mayan symbols. They seem to stand for his conviction that a vital element in his environment, and therefore in himself, had been suppressed, denied, or merely mummified, and needed to be recognized and freed. This was true for him, despite the fact that he was dependent for his knowledge on archaeology, museums, and books, like anyone else, aside, that is, from what he learned directly from the Warao. Williams described the murals he painted for Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, Canada, as composed of dismembered and rearranged totems. This phrase seems a perfect description of his method, although a matter-of-fact one compared with what was, in painterly terms, a passionate and searching process. His work appears as a kind of investigation of the pre-Columbian legacy that a painter, not a scientist, could make. A deconstruction, refusing to take the given as fixed and final, dismembering and reassembling the components. There is the continuous sense of meltdown, of chaotic turmoil, but also of germination, growth, and construction. In Mayan culture, painting and writing were close together in their systems. Mayan glyphs were small, compressed conglomerates of pictorial elements. They often surround the main figurative images with a close stylistic concordance. And Mayan writing is said to have given scribes some latitude for virtuosity and playful invention. In Aubrey Williams's paintings, the particulars of this cultural artifact mix and merge with the cosmic, electrical energy, cells, molecules, stars. The borderline between nature and culture, or universe and mind, is consciously explored and played with. This is made explicit in drawings left in the artist's notebooks, graphic clusters recorded by the painter's improvising hand, which seeks to define or divine life. It's fascinating the way the linguistic signs, with their borders and signifying elements, bear a resemblance to the biological cell, with its walls and nucleus. Both are melting into one another. Some signs could equally be the walls, scales, and excrescences round a fish's mouth, or the lines round a bird's eye. If one speaks of Aubrey himself gaining the recognition he deserves as a painter, one must also speak of the way the driving force of his art has come to seem more and more pertinent to the global predicament we find ourselves in. At least as important a fact about the Maya as their symbology for Aubrey was the sudden collapse of the Mayan state, as he referred to in the film extract, in obscure circumstances, leaving an ominous silence in the historical record. Aubrey was convinced that the Mayan catastrophe was due to a runaway technology and that the Mayan predicament had close parallels with our own in the modern world. The destruction wrought by colonial conquest was another phase in this process, and the present ecological crisis was essentially a continuation of colonialist greed. I quote, "Now the faults are with us, with humanity," Aubrey wrote. It would be hard to exaggerate how deeply he felt about the desecration of our global environment and the acuteness of his anxiety. In his view, it was all, in his view, it was already too late. This anxiety is perhaps the aspect which has grown to assume the greatest importance in our consciousness, into which the birds fit and which ties together the most abstract and the most figurative references in his work. I hope we could examine in more detail the nature of Aubrey Williams' ecological consciousness in the course of these discussions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Guy. And as I said before, there will be an opportunity at the end of the session today for a discussion and questions. But now I'd like to swap over to this mic and introduce the three speakers who will then go on and have a discussion on the stage between themselves. Each of them will do a short presentation. And I'll introduce all three of them up front, and then they will each come up. So, first of all, Dr. Anne Walmsley, who's a freelance writer and researcher, and of course an expert in Caribbean art and literature. She's worked in the Caribbean and lived there and worked as a teacher and a publisher for many, many years and continues to visit regularly. And of course, her publications include the study on the Caribbean artist movement from 1966 to 77, as well as Guyana Dreaming, the art of Aubrey Williams. The second person to present will be Dr. Hassan Arero, who, of course, is the keeper of anthropology at the Horniman Museum in southeast London and was the first black African curator to be appointed by a British museum in 2002. And, of course, he also curated last year's hugely successful exhibition, Amazon to Caribbean, Early Peoples of the Rainforest, and is himself a fellow of the Royal Anthropological Institute and has numerous publications and done extensive research on African and Caribbean diaspora communities. And finally, the third speaker will be Adrian Glue, who himself curated the Aubrey Williams display that is in the Goodison Room at the moment, as well as collecting the really nice, interesting collection of Aubrey Williams ephemera that you can see just outside the auditorium here. And he's actively involved with the Society of Archivists, the Musgrave Kinley Outsider Art Trusts, and the Public Monuments and Sculpture Association. And I'm ashamed to say I met him for the first time today, which shows what a dysfunctional organization Tate is. Anyway, that's enough from me, so I'd like to introduce Anne, please.
Greetings, friends, old and new. I'd like to start with a quotation from a talk given by Aubrey Williams in September 1967. Wonderfully appropriate to be quoting it today, exactly 40 years on. Much of my work has come out of a long contemplation and a search into the pre-Columbian civilizations in the New World, primarily the Aztec, the Maya, the Toltec, and the Inca. Also, a long immersion in the work of our South American Indians in Guyana. We are lucky to have our roots still in the earth of the Caribbean. We are still in a position to contemplate terrestrial reality. We should be proud of our non-figuration. We should be proud of the essences of human existence that the people from this neck of the woods have produced in the world. We must become more involved with the visual output of our artists in the Caribbean because they are going to change the real seeing of the world. Aubrey was speaking at the first conference of the Caribbean Artist Movement, CAM, in response to a challenge posed by the keynote speaker that the rapid jump from being long-time British colonials to world citizens of the 20th century should first be made in the creative arts. All of us who heard Aubrey speak then and at many other CAM events, who saw his paintings on show alongside, who came to know Aubrey through CAM, were profoundly affected by what he told us and showed us. Our perceptions forever changed. It is marvellous to find that, 40 years on, Aubrey's paintings are being shown in an increasing number of venues in a variety of contexts, not confined to those of the Caribbean, and that they are attracting the attention, changing the perceptions of new generations of viewers. We, his friends in CAM, welcome the current show here at Tate Britain and today's event. We hope it will stimulate more of the serious study which Aubrey's work in painting demands and deserves. I have been asked to speak today about Aubrey's participation in CAM, of which he was a founding and active member, and of its crucial timing in Aubrey's life in London. While I speak, three outstanding abstract paintings by Aubrey from around the CAM period will be projected. If I can press the right button. Is it next for the first one? Sorry. Oh, nothing's happened. Oh, yes. Thank you. That is Visual Idea. And then... Oh, sorry. They're not in the order I expected. Never mind. That is Guyana. No, that's Visual Idea. I beg your pardon. It was Warrow first, then Visual Idea, and the third one... Oh, sorry, seem to have missed one. Oh. Sorry, I'm pressing previous and nothing's happening. Sorry, what have I done?
Right.
Sorry, Jen, what have I done? I'm pressing.
It's coming up now.
Is it coming up?
There's
now?
A first one, right?
Okay, that's Guyana.
Just go next. When
yes, okay. Thank you very much. Okay. That's Guyana. And I just want to give you another quote in relation to these three works, which I'm going to try and press the button so that you have the three coming up while I'm speaking. Early in CAM, four CAM writers visited Aubrey in his studio, April 67. And Aubrey said to them, "All the time I'm trying for visual strengths, forms that disturb. They intensify your looking, seeing, feeling power." So first of all, Aubrey as a founding and active member of CAM. Aubrey participated in CAM at every level, in Britain and in the Caribbean, throughout its life. More, I think, than any of the other artists in CAM, though they ranged from Ronald Moody and Althea McNeish to Errol Lloyd and Paul Dash. Errol and Paul are here with us today. He dutifully attended CAM committee meetings and took part in planning CAM's programme. He engaged in long, serious discussions with fellow CAM members, outstandingly, in his studio with Wilson Harris alongside the three CAM founders, Kamau Brathwaite, John LaRose and Andrew Salkey, and at many get-togethers in CAM members' houses. He named these occasions Warishis, occasions for unburdening, from an American Indian word. At public sessions and conferences, he spoke most memorably several times and joined in discussion, and he showed his work in the many CAM art exhibitions. Here was Aubrey, used to one-man shows in London and Milan, Paris and Zurich, eager to have his paintings hung alongside work by beginner, unknown West Indian artists at venues such as the Theatre Royal Stratford or the LSE. Then what Aubrey's participation meant to CAM? Aubrey himself was very modest about the significance of his role in CAM. He defined it to me simply as a concern to define a Caribbean aesthetic in the arts. But how much more than that? The participation and presence of an artist of such standing, as with Ronald Moody, greatly increased CAM's confidence and feeling of empowerment. Then the chance for young would-be artists and others to hear and talk with a fully committed professional artist, many for the first time. The challenge of Aubrey's straight speaking. He rebuked fellow intellectuals for their low level of visual art appreciation. He challenged them to go home and think, asserting that the language of painting is just as valid a language as the words used by a writer. He urged CAM members to appreciate the vital, accessible role in society of the visual arts. His embrace of the multidisciplinary character of CAM, practitioners of all art forms coming together, which reflected his own many-sided creativity and interests. His help to CAM members towards an understanding of abstraction in art, which he defended as no less socially committed than figurative painting, though denying it as a label for his own work. The way in which, as with Wilson Harris, Aubrey brought the particularity of Guyana to CAM. As Brathwaite put it, he emphasized the importance of local primordial man and thus extended the boundaries of our sensibility. Most of all, most of us, coming from islands where there was no evident lost civilization, faced a real artistic difficulty in our search for origins. And then what CAM meant to Aubrey. In Imru Bukhari's wonderful mid-80s film about Aubrey, which you've just seen an extract of and we'll see more of, Aubrey says, "I am not a group person. I'm really a loner, you see. But I can occasionally find harmony within a group if I'm terribly interested and exciting about what a group is doing." Statements made by Aubrey elsewhere in the late 1980s, in his extensive conversation with Rashida Reen in Third Text, during a forum with young artists in Brixton towards a black aesthetic, in an interview which he gave me at the start of my research on CAM, it was clear that CAM was such a group. To me, Aubrey said, "I can remember being in CAM and working for CAM and thinking about CAM and constantly of painting. I haven't had the same feeling about any other movement I've been involved in. The actual satisfaction one had from doing the slightest thing through CAM." How Aubrey saw CAM's role in Caribbean visual practice. He firmly believed that the living presence of CAM is still present in the creative community of the Caribbean. When CAM was formed in Britain in 1966, Aubrey was excited about its potential for enabling more art of the Caribbean to be seen and understood in Britain. Aubrey said, "I think that, though late, we've got the vehicle now, at least in England. We've got CAM." In contrast, in 1986, he lamented to me, "If we had an active CAM up to now, I would have had ammunition. I would have had a pool to return to. I would have had a machine to use. We could put on a big show. We could go anywhere." Aubrey took a great interest in and encouragement for my research into and writing on CAM. He believed in the importance of people knowing about the movement, especially the modern working creative person of Caribbean descent, this new generation of Caribbeans here in Britain. He stressed, too, the importance of putting on record the contribution CAM has made regarding the emergence of a Caribbean aesthetic in the arts. I notice I seem to have changed my pronunciation when I'm quoting Aubrey. And finally, the significance of Aubrey for the timing of CAM. When he spoke at that first CAM conference in 1967, Aubrey had been in Britain for 15 years. His participation in CAM came at a crucial moment for him as an artist working in Britain. By 1966, he had begun to feel, as he later told Rashid Areen, terribly isolated physically and intellectually. He was being largely ignored or marginalized by the mainstream art world of Britain, after a very encouraging, promising start, and he had just begun a series of return visits to the Caribbean, which increased in frequency and length. Aubrey had come to Britain in 1952 not primarily as an artist, but as an agronomist on leave from the Department of Agriculture in British Guyana to study agricultural engineering. In Guyana, alongside, he had shown an early gift for an interest in art, attended the working people's art class, and found himself deeply impressed by the art of Guyana's indigenous Indians. After much travel within Britain and on the continent, much viewing of the art there, he settled in London, married Eve, his sweetheart from Guyana, and spent more and more time painting. He did a year at St. Martin's. He took full advantage of several groundbreaking, influential shows of abstract impressionist artists from the USA, and of solo shows of work by Arshil Gorky, originally from Turkish Armenia, of Rufino Tamayo from Mexico. Aubrey started showing his paintings as early as 1954. His shows of 1958, 59, and 1960 at the New Vision Centre Gallery launched him, gave him confidence as an artist in Britain. The gallery's policy was to show young and unknown non-figurative artists and for international membership. Aubrey's work was well reviewed. His 1958 show resulted in invitations to show on the continent in the USA, and his work also sold well. He showed with, made friends amongst outstanding contemporary abstract artists from Britain and elsewhere. In 1963, he had solo shows at the Grabowski Gallery in Sloane Street, London, and one at a leading gallery in Dublin, both of which attracted much serious critical attention. But these apart, Aubrey now began to be shown almost entirely as a Commonwealth artist. The opening of the Commonwealth Institute's new building in Kensington High Street, with its purpose-built, state-of-the-art, huge art gallery, resulted in a succession of exhibitions of Commonwealth art. Aubrey's work was eagerly welcomed in such a context, and one of his paintings awarded first prize in the first Biennale of Commonwealth Abstract Art. His solo show at the Institute in 1965 was his most extensive to date, with 40 paintings on show. But such shows were not considered part of the main British art scene and largely ignored by reviewers. <clears throat> 1966 was a turning point. We've now moved to Warrow appropriately. In May, Aubrey had his first chance to return to Guyana. Invited with his wife Eve and their baby daughter Maridawa for Guyana's independence, Aubrey was able to meet fellow Caribbean artists and writers also invited and to see his work displayed alongside theirs. He was also reunited with his home patch in South America. As a naturalist, agronomist, environmentalist, passionate advocate of the region's indigenous culture, one can only imagine what this must have meant to him. And that December, Aubrey was invited to join the newly formed CAM. He not only accepted, but became one of its core most active members. The timing was perfect, for himself personally and for his development as an artist. During the CAM years, 1966 to 1972, Aubrey paid a succession of visits back to Guyana for the Republic celebrations, to paint the murals at Temeri Airport, to present paintings of Guyana myths to the museum, to take part in the first Carifesta in 1972. During these years, in 1970, he also paid his first visit to Jamaica at the invitation of Carl Pabu Singh, a leading Jamaican artist. The visit was of special significance, not only for Aubrey's show at the John Pear Tree Gallery, home of the Contemporary Jamaican Artists Association, which Kamau Brathwaite opened with his now classic Temeri speech, but also for the night Aubrey spent with Charter 15,